in our midst both the previous distinguished Majewski series lecturer and the one who is going to give us today. Professor Ursula King is here to address us on a very important topic, Hinduism and Women, Uses and Abuses of Religious Freedom. Now, to introduce her to us, I would like to call upon Peggy Morgan, who knows her better than I do, and therefore, Peggy, would you please?
Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome Ursula to Oxford again. She comes quite often and has previously done the annual Robert White lecture for us, in which she then published later, which was an annual lecture linked with the seminar series that I convened with Keith Ward. I know Ursula best for her being a very dynamic presence in the British Association for the Study of Religions, where she did wonderful things both as secretary at one point, as bulletin editor, and more lately as one of our presidents. And she gave the annual lecture for us at the conference in Oxford in September, which was our 50th anniversary conference. She's done a lot of pioneering things. Some of you will have heard of the Community Religions Project, which continues to publish studies, sometimes anthropological, sometimes more historical, sometimes sociological, based at the University of Leeds. And she, with Michael Pye and Kim Knott, was there a researcher at the very first stage, were pioneers in getting that off the ground. And that continues to be a very important set of studies. She's also been a pioneer in the whole area of religion and gender, in which she's published widely with other scholars around the world, but also her own, and particularly focused on India and Hindu studies. She's been very involved in the second edition of the Eliade, multi-volumed Encyclopedia of Religion, encouraging, persuading the editors to include a lot of articles which were really noticeable by their omission, particularly on women scholars, in the very first edition. We're all looking forward to when that... Have we got a date when that's
out? It's out. It's on my bookshelf.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I haven't seen it yet, which just shows how behind I am. So
no, it's, I don't think anybody else
has seen it. Oh, that's all right. Not just good, but anyway, it's out, but we haven't got it yet, as it were, but it will be... the first edition is in many of Oxford's libraries, so it will be, and you'll be able to trace all the many... I'm sure very excellent articles that she's written herself and encouraged others to be asked to write in that. So it's a great pleasure to have you with us, Ursula. Thank you for coming to Oxford again and for delivering this lecture on Hinduism and Women, Uses and Abuses of Religious Freedom.
Thank you very much for that very generous and kind introduction, Peggy. I'm absolutely delighted to be here, and I feel greatly honoured that you have asked me to give this Majewski or Majewski lecture, however it is pronounced. As you have talked about the Encyclopedia of Religion, that gives me an opportunity to just say two or three words or two or three sentences about it. It is a magnificent work, I must say this. I have seen it. It's there now on my bookshelves. It just came out about 3 weeks ago, and it is an expanded version. It's the same, and it's very different from the first version, because in addition to the 1,000 articles that were revised from the new version, there are 1,000 new entries, 1.5 million new words. So it's a huge edition, and the largest edition is actually Gender and Religion. And of course religion, ecology and religion, law and religion, human rights and religion. I mean, there are one arts and religion, there are some visual essays. Each volume has a visual essay according to a theme, like sacred time or rites or pilgrimage, beautifully illustrated with color photographs. It's a magnificent reference work which will certainly be used very widely. And I mean, just to give you an idea about gender and religion, some of you will know this already because I've spoken about this elsewhere. I was asked to do between 8 to 10, get 8 to 10 contributors for gender and religion articles. We finished up with 20 religious traditions. So, you know, it's become a mammoth task, not just for me, but for everybody. The editor-in-chief says the same thing. When they started, they had an open, ended kind of field, and it's grown and grown and grown. So everything is much bigger than they first imagined. So it will be very valuable for references. And, I mean, they're superb and very wide-ranging articles on Hinduism, and some of you may have contributed to that. It's really a wonderful reference work for students and researchers, whether you look at Jainism or Mesoamerican religions or Celtic religions or new religious movements is another very big area that has come into it. Medicine and healing and religion, you know, it's, I mean, they're wonderful entries. Also on religion and literature, religion and the novel. I mean, quite unexpected kind of opening. So it's exciting. It's really exciting. It has theoretical and lots of empirical data, and it's really very, very useful as a reference work. And it will probably go online eventually. They're working on this at the moment. So let me come back. It's not unrelated to what I'm going to say, but let me come back to my paper, which I suggested to Sharnika, when we talked about this last year at a conference at SOAS. I suggested this because it was a paper I just had written, and the paper has now just come out in print, so if you like, I can give you an off-print later. But it came originally out of a conference on religion, women, and human rights organized by the Oslo Human Rights Institute and the Faculty of Theology at Oslo. And I was asked to speak there on this aspect, religion, human rights, women, human rights, and Hinduism. And I gave a short presentation, and I was then invited to contribute a whole article, which is very, very long, which is twice the length of a paper, really, for a desk book for governments and agencies around the world on facilitating freedom of religion or belief, which has been produced by the Oslo Human Rights Institute. So this was a very exciting task. And I did research at the Oslo Human Rights Institute and also at SOAS. And I would like to also commemorate here and particularly mention Julia Leslie, who is well known to several of you and who was, of course, on the Academic Advisory Council of the Oxford Centre of Hindu Studies. Julia, her very last piece that she wrote, she told me this personally 2 weeks before she died, was a piece on gender and Hinduism in the Encyclopedia of Religion. And it's a splendid piece. You see, she really looks at the whole historical and theoretical aspect. I just reread it on the train. It's a wonderful piece. And she said, that is what I will be remembered by. So she wrote that. She wrote the article on Sati. And, of course, she was in her own publications, very gender-oriented. And she also was responsible for organizing a conference in 2003, which some of you may have been to, on the 6th International Conference on Dowry, Bride Burning, and Son Preference, which is directly relevant to this theme. I just thought I mentioned this by way of introduction. Now, this paper on Hinduism and women, uses and abuses of religious freedom, starts with understanding religion and women, human rights in India. Now, I will not read all the general kind of introduction and the aspects on the traditional image of women in Hinduism, because that is familiar to you, but it is not familiar to a general readership to whom this book is addressed. But I start with a dedication from a book edited by Madhukishwa and Ruth Vanita, In Search of Answers, which starts with this little motto: to all those women of India, some known, but mostly unknown, whose lives have been devoted to the struggle for freedom and dignity. These voices express the complex experience and problems of women in contemporary India. Their words succinctly convey the great struggle of Indian women in searching to live a life of human dignity and worth, a life that must encompass both the freedom of women and the freedom of religion in an ancient culture. My paper explores some of the areas where the freedom of religion or belief in India is in tension with or even clashes with the human rights of Indian women today. this is not an easy issue to tackle, because I'm not an Indian, but a European woman who's been shaped by quite a different culture. I just want to mention that, for those of you who may not know this, I lived and studied and also lectured in India for 5 years, but it's a very long time ago now. I came back in 1970, which dates me somewhat. But I worked quite a bit with Indian women, and I have, of course, been back since, and I have interviewed women who have been involved with a struggle for women's justice or questions about poverty or about violence and so on. So what surprised me, when I was first asked to speak about the uses and abuses of religious freedom in relation to Hinduism and women, when I consulted the Human Rights Institute library, which is very extensive and very international, I was really quite shocked to find out that human rights in general are far less discussed with regards to Hinduism than they are with Islam, than with regards to Islam and Christianity. There's very little literature, comparatively speaking, very little legal literature on human rights in relation to religion, and in Indological literature, in traditional literature on Hinduism, the question of human rights does usually not get treated. And if this applies to Hinduism and human rights, it applies even more so to Hinduism and women's human rights. There is really very, very little work done on this. I came across a very early article by Vetnanda from about 25 years ago on Hinduism and human rights, where he just has half a page on the status of women. That's about all. Now, Arvind Sharma has just published in 2004 a book on Hinduism and human rights. Have you seen that, Peggy? No, has anyone? You have seen it. I mean, that's a book that's come out by the OEP in New York, where he tries to pursue, he makes this very clear, it's a conceptual approach to see what resources, what ideas, what practices of traditional Hinduism may provide inspirations, help, support for human rights debates today. But I think he, again, is not particularly interested in women's human rights. It's human rights in general. He said, right, human rights in general. So it's very difficult to find material. Rachana Kaushal, she wrote something in 2000. She wrote a book on women and human rights in India, where she just provides a useful survey of women's human rights, crimes against women, the exploitation of women in India, together with the documentation of the relevant Indian laws. But she only touches very indirectly on the relation between women's human rights abuses and traditional Hindu beliefs and practices. Besides the lack, the general lack of literature on Hinduism and women's human rights, there are of course all the complex problems with which you will be familiar about the complexity of Indian society in terms of its ethnic and religious diversity, but there is also, in addition, political entity has a secular constitution, but also many religion-based laws for its different religious communities. There has been a lively debate to create a uniform civil code, the UCC, for all religious groups in Indian society, but this has not happened yet. The influence of Hinduism, which is such an all-pervasive cultural factor in Indian society, has been further strengthened over the last two decades through its narrow, exclusive redefinition for political purposes by the Hindu right, or by the radical Hindu right, as some people say. And this has important implications for women. Now, both Hinduism and women are not stable, unified categories with one specific meanings. Each comprises complex. And what is understood by Hinduism today, or at least what is claimed to be Hinduism by current Hindu political parties with strong right-wing fundamentalist tendencies, is to some extent an idealized construction created during the colonial period of the 19th and post-colonial period of the 20th century. Scholars prefer to speak of the many Hinduisms, or to characterize Hinduism as a family of religions rather than one religion. The internal pluralism significant of Hinduism applies to Indian women too. For like women elsewhere, Indian women consist of many different groups, whether they are rural or urban women, educated or illiterate women, migrant women, women workers, housewives, mothers, women professionals. The understanding of Hindu religious beliefs and practices will enormously vary between these different groups, and it is therefore not easy to speak of Hinduism and women in general and relate this to the debate about Hindu women rights, women's rights. Quite a few contemporary Indian women and men are fighting for greater gender justice in a society still marked by great gender disparities, where many violent crimes are committed against women and girl children. The Indian state has provided constitutional legal protection of both religious rights and women's rights. Article 14 of the Indian Constitution forbids all discrimination based on sex, and Article 51 stipulates, I quote, to renounce practices derogatory to the dignity of women, unquote. Moreover, the Indian state has signed all the major international human rights instruments, yet sadly, it still violates them. India possesses adequate legal resources to support and advance human rights, but social practice lags far behind legal theory. This is a very interesting kind of gap. Between 1971 and 1974, the Indian government set up a committee on the status of women, whose report recognized that the majority of women were still far from enjoying the rights and opportunities guaranteed to them by the Constitution. Now, there are lots of quotations, but I won't go into those now. I have tried to present my argument to a wider readership, which is not the audience here today, by first of all looking at the images and roles of women in traditional Hinduism, but I take it that you're familiar with those, so I will skip that section. Then secondly, I have a section on the Indian women's movement and the struggle for women's rights, and I say something about that. And then a third section on the denial of and crimes against the human rights of Indian women, and fourthly, the right to religious freedom and women's human rights in India, is there an insoluble conflict? So we skip this section about, which is very long, because I had to explain to people what the contemporary situation is and the symbolism and the kind of tension between, you know, the mother image and the wife image and the goddesses and the symbolism in terms of religion and the ultimate philosophical level where sexual opposites do not exist and the way it works in the bhakti movement and so on. So I will not go into that. All I want to say, I quote here Prabhati Mukherjee, who has, in her study on Hindu women normative models, comes to the conclusion that the normative models of Hindu women consist, the ideal of womanhood, largely held by Brahmins, is really a wife ideal rather than an ideal woman, which is quite an interesting idea. What is important is that it's generally held that the women enjoyed a much higher position during the ancient Vedic period. Perhaps they even held religious equality with men then, and in the following periods of Hinduism, we find a growing restriction for women, eventually codified in the Hindu law books, particularly the laws of Manu. However, whilst the position of women during the period before the codification of classical textually sanctioned Hinduism was no doubt quite different, the question arises whether the romantic idealization of an Aryan golden age, largely reconstructed during the 19th century Hindu Renaissance, did not also create a particularly idealized view of past Indian womanhood, in contrast to the actual position of Indian women during the modern colonial period. The interpretation of the Indian past and of the images and roles of women in traditional Hinduism has become a contested field of discourse ever since the 19th century, ever since then when the reformers tried to improve the position of Indian women. And I want to say a little bit more about that. The Indian women's movement and the struggle for women's rights, which is very well dealt with up to a certain period, up to 1990, in Radha Kumar's book, The History of Doing, an illustrated account of movements for women's rights and feminism in India, 1800 to 1990, which I'm sure several of you will know. Modern female education was first started in the 19th century by Christian missionaries, especially their wives, but it was soon vigorously promoted by Hindu reformers. A lively debate developed between progressives and gradualists. The gradualists believed that in the gradual education of women in preparation for being a good wife and mother, thereby reinforcing traditional ideals, whereas the progressives championed the same education for women as for men, including full access to Western ideas. The advance of women's education in 19th century Bengal, which really spearheaded this development, was first largely due to progressive men of the urban middle class who had received Western education themselves and wanted their wives and daughters to be educated. But Orthodox Hindus also began to recognize the need for traditional education and for Hindu religious instruction, and therefore gradually allowed some women to learn Sanskrit and thereby enabled them to gain access to the Hindu scriptures, which had remained closed to them for so long. Following a generally accepted feminist typology today, a distinction is made between the first wave of the Indian women's movement concerned with women's uplift and equal rights, lasting from the late 19th century to the mid-20th century, during the existence of Imperial India. The second wave focuses on women's rights and empowerment, and this emerged in independent India from the mid-20th century onwards. The history of the Indian women's movement is therefore closely interwoven with that of colonialism and post-colonialism. During the first wave, Hindu reformers and revivalists vigorously debated the so-called woman question. In the beginning of the Indian women's movement can be dated with the foundation of Rana Dey's Indian National Social Conference in 1887. But soon pioneering women emerged who developed the Indian women's movement through creating numerous autonomous organizations formed by and for women, and this is very important. Some of the largest and most important of these were the Women's Indian Association, formed in 1917, the National Council of Women, founded in 1920, and the All India Women's Conference, founded in 1926, so that's almost 100 years ago. It is important to realize that these were inclusive secular movements for all Indian, not only Hindu women. Their members were drawn from an urban-based social elite who, through education, had gained access to professional positions. Their programs were largely devoted to social work and improvement of women's lives, without planning any fundamental change for Indian society or in the traditional areas of Hindu religious life. The Indian women's movement, starting in the late 19th century, brought together women from many different backgrounds, whether Hindus, Muslim, Parsis, or Western women. There also existed other religiously affiliated women's organizations, such as the Sri Zoroastrian Mandal, founded by a Parsi woman as early as 1903, or the All India Muslim Women's Conference, established in 1916. But the majority of women's work was carried out by inclusive All India Women's Associations, where, however, Hindu references shaped the dominant discourse due to the all-pervasive presence and cultural dominance of Hinduism in the Indian subcontinent. Now that's the 19th and mid-20th century, up to the mid-20th century. During the 20th century, the single most important influence in improving the status of Indian women was their active participation in the independence movement and the great encouragement and support given to women by Mahatma Gandhi. One can say, as a sort of general rule, that women came into the public sphere through taking part in the independence movement. Through the protest and imprisonment, women became much more visible in Indian life than they had been before. Gandhi created a more widely based mass movement during the mid and late 20th century. The Indian women's movement still remained by and large an elite minority phenomenon, with little effect on the downtrodden position of the vast majority of rural women. In fact, investigations by the Indian Social Science Research Council during the 1970s showed a trend of continued deterioration in the condition of women since independence for the country as a whole, evidenced by higher mortality, low literacy, an accelerated decline in women's participation in the labor force and in decision-making bodies at national level. That's a pretty dire statement for the 1970s. But it was also during the same time, during the 1970s, that the contemporary feminist movement emerged in India and more widely based women's action groups started. These were concerned with wider issues of women's health and labor, the increasing violence against women evident in wife beating, dowry deaths, or the abortion of female fetuses based on prenatal sex selection and son preference, and many other concerns. They organized campaigns against women's oppression, whether against dowry, rape, later against sati and religion-based personal laws, the abuse of alcohol, the use of religion to divide women, or the necessary support for a safe environment. The contemporary situation is marked by several tensions and paradoxes. There exists first the continuing contrast between the traditional ideal of the Indian Hindu woman, embodied in several epic heroines and goddess figures, and the Western-derived image of the modern woman as a person in her own right, with a sense of personal identity, subjectivity, and autonomy. A woman with full human rights. Modern women seek liberation from subordination and oppression, but this liberation stands often in stark contrast and tension to the ultimate Hindu ideal of religious liberation, which is linked to the fulfillment of Hindu duties or dharma. It is, and it has been pointed out, that it is problematic to speak of rights and equality, to use this discourse when contrasted, compared with, or linked to dharma and the whole area of duties. We could discuss it later. Further tension exists regarding the understanding of what the Hindu tradition consists of. This tension is historically grounded in the 19th century Hindu reformers' critical reappropriation of the Indian past, which made much use of the new construct of a golden age of ancient Indian civilization. This provided reformers not only with the model of an ideal ancient society, which could be recreated in modern India, but Hindu sacred literature also contained lofty ideals of womanhood, which could be equally applied to contemporary society. Different proponents of the equal rights of Indian women developed contrasting styles of reading the Hindu past, finding arguments there both for and against women's social and political rights. And this is basically the debate which is still going on. Now, when we examine Hindu scriptures, we find, like in many other or most other religions, there are many ambiguities and contradictions in relation to statements about women. And therefore, these scriptures are open to very divergent interpretations, sanctioning very different customs. Here the work of the 19th century British colonial administration in defining Hindu law by translating traditional texts to provide a basis for decision-making of colonial administrators is an important factor which influences the implementation of women's rights today. The extensive codification of Hindu law, which took place under British colonial rule, can be seen and is being seen by Indian women activists as the freezing of Hindu law in its 19th century form, carrying a strong anti-woman bias. This is a very interesting argument. The Indian woman lawyer activist Flavia Agnes has pointed out that when the colonial legal codification took place, Hindu scriptural passages were not uniformly anti-women and contained spaces for negotiating women's rights. Nor were the sacred texts meant to be legal statutes. The English translation of the original Hindu texts subverted much of their context and meaning, especially as the anti-women biases and Orientalist approaches of the translators themselves colored much of the formulation of the Hindu code bills and the Anglo-Indian-derived Muslim personal laws. So they were both colored by, you know, the English Orientalist lenses, if you like, colonialist lenses. Many of the texts were also used to co-opt the anti-women provisions of 19th century English matrimonial statutes and women's economic rights in the British family. The colonial lawmakers considered family property relationships as primarily legal matters to be governed by the colonial state's own versions of each group's religious laws. Thus, they facilitated the construction of an Anglo-Indian amalgam that came to be known as each religious community's personal law, which in spite of the considerable personal law reforms of colonial statutes since independence, is still in force and much debated today. Hindus, Muslims, Parsis, and Christians were given their own distinct personal laws, but for political reasons, Buddhists, Jains, Sikhs and Jews were not. Now this is a very, very complicated and quite intriguing legal kind of position, as you can imagine. A close scrutiny of Indian personal laws shows how gender discrimination prevails in their interpretation and application despite constitutional guarantees of the equality of women. Women activists fight for an abolition of these personal laws and the creation of a uniform civil code, the UCC, for all Indian citizens. The Hindu political right also favors the abolition of personal laws, but for different reasons, as I will show later. If the freedom of religion or belief is a universal human right, the absolute, unconditional use of this right can be seen under certain circumstances to entail an abuse through the denial of the full human rights of women, especially their economic, social, and political equality, if the anti-women elements of traditional Hindu beliefs and practices, as well as of Hindu personal laws, are socially accepted and practiced, as well as politically encouraged and justified. This paradoxical dilemma of a clash between two differently articulated human rights, the right to religious freedom and the rights of women, characterizes much of the contemporary situation in India, where many crimes against women's human rights occur that are directly or indirectly related to traditional religious beliefs and deeply ingrained social practices rooted in Hindu religious culture. Now I come to my third section. I will have to also cut this a bit because it's another 10 or 15 pages. The Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, usually referred to as CEDAW, adopted by the United Nations in 1979, has issued several general recommendations touching on conflicts between the obligations of the Convention and traditional religious and cultural practices, which include statements, and I'm quoting this, which include statements identifying traditional attitudes that perpetuate such violent and coercive practices as forced marriage, dowry death, and female circumcision as contributing to discrimination against women. India is a country, in fact it's a continent, where such conflicts between religious and cultural practices occur when women are submitted to coercive violent practices. Similarly, the Women International Human Rights Law, which is a big book on law, carries a whole section on, I quote, common abuses of women around the world, which deals, among others, with violence against women, domestic violence, sexual harassment, discrimination, and trafficking in women. Fundamental rights and civil liberties guaranteed by the Indian Constitution are denied to many sections of the Indian population, but the most oppressed within each oppressed group are women. Women are doubly oppressed, from the outside as member of an oppressed group, from the inside by male members of their own group, as well as by men outside their own group. This is particularly true of Dalit women, formerly called untouchables, on whom the Human Rights Watch has produced a special report in 1999. I can't go into all this. They've also produced another report on rape for profit, trafficking of Nepali girls and women to India's brothels, which is another of their Human Rights Watch reports. In an article of the early 1980s, Madhu Kishwa, one of the best-known figures of the Indian women's movement, founder of Manushi, the women's feminist publication, foundation of which dates from 1979. In 1980, she analyzed the denial of fundamental rights to Indian women. This makes very depressing reading and still reflects much of the current situation. She points to the traditional Indian family structure as providing little outside support for women and accounting for much of women's general lack of freedom and rights in the male-dominated family. While not denying that in many Indian homes women receive more than adequate love and care, she argues that the majority of women are kept in various types of bondage and almost all the fundamental rights and civil liberties guaranteed in the Constitution are frequently snatched from women by powerful members of their own families. I'm quoting her here. For too many women in India, their own fathers, brothers and husbands act like virtual prison guards, holding them captive and keeping them in a state of perpetual fear within the walls of their own homes, and denying them the right to make or even to take part in making the most fundamental decisions about their own lives. You can see this in Madhukishwa's, you can read this in Madhukishwa's article, Denial of Fundamental Rights to Women, in the book I quoted at the beginning. She looks at some of the fundamental rights enshrined in the Indian Constitution and discusses how these rights are denied to Indian women, such rights as protection of life and personal liberty, freedom of movement, right to choose an occupation, right against exploitation, right to form associations and union, right to property, right to freedom of speech and expression, and so on. According to Kishwa, in the currently still prevalent traditional Indian family system, women are mainly used as commodities, this is a quotation again, as vehicles for transfer of consumer forms of property from one family to another. Even control over women, as over slaves, is passed from one owner, the parent's family, to the other, the husband's family. By and for themselves, women can seldom acquire any real control over even what is customarily supposed to be theirs, such as jewelry and household goods given to them as dowry. Thus, she maintains, I quote, that the chains for women's bondage are first forged in the family, and the silencing of women begins there as well. But she also sees signs of hope in that struggles are beginning to emerge all over the country in which women demand independent rights. Now, these struggles have become public through the emergence and proliferation of autonomous women's groups in India during the 1970s and 80s. I've mentioned Manushi in that respect. There's a lot more to be said. But it is sometimes criticized, it's sometimes said that Indian feminists are accused of imitating Western women, of being colonialists, cultural imperialists, supporters of capitalist ideology, and so on. But the wide response to these autonomous women's groups and their practical campaigns shows that the demand for women's human rights have taken genuinely Indian roots. Now, then I have a lot about dowry and sati, which I think I will have to leave because it's going to be too long, and dowry murders, which is one of the great problems in India today. And I have also got some figures. Well, these figures are already 20 years old, but I mean, when you look at these are actually some quoted in Klostermeyer, one of Klostermeyer's studies, where in Delhi alone, between 1979 to 1988, 2,055 young wives aged between 18 to 25 died in presumably prearranged kerosene stove burning accidents, victims of dowry murders. Just imagine that, over 2,000 people. Sati, there's a famous, the very famous sati of the 18-year-old Roop Kanwar in 1987 in Rajasthan, which produced an enormous amount of debate both in India and internationally and led to quite a lot of publications, conferences, and so on. But this much-publicized event led to heated public debate, as I just said, and many demonstrations for and against sati. The burning of the cremation of the woman with her husband, or separate immolation sometime after the husband's cremation. So there's a whole question about the definition of what sati is and who is a sati. But what is now very, very interesting and makes the situation really complex is that already in 1983, this sati was in 1987, but already in 1983, there existed an organization, and I don't know that many people here would know this, known as the Rani Sati Sava Sangh, the RSSS. It has one more S than the political party, the RSSS, funded by the Marwari community, India's most important group of merchants and industrialists. They launched in 1983 a campaign in Delhi to popularize sati. The RSSS ran already several sati temples in Rajasthan and Delhi, and they had been granted a plot of land by the Indian government on which they wanted to build another temple in honor of Sati. They organized a procession of men and women to celebrate this grant. Now, Delhi feminists tried to organize a counter-demonstration, which, however, proved a failure as they were outnumbered and rather distressed by having to confront other women in a hostile situation. It turned out that the procession had appropriated the language of rights, stating that they should have the right, as Hindus and as women, to commit worship and propagate sati. At the same time, they also appropriated feminist slogans on women's militancy. For example, they'd say, "We, the women of India, are not flowers but fiery sparks. We are going to commit sati." This distressing experience determined Indian feminists to undertake research into the existence of sati temples, and of the proponents of sati dharma, the religion of sati, created in India after independence. It is estimated that on average one sati occurs per year, and the campaign for sati and neo-fundamentalist Hinduism, with which Rajput identity is now fused, revealed the increasing opposition to feminism among a certain part of the Indian Hindu population and represented a setback for the Indian feminist movement. The question of sati is literally and metaphorically a burning question, as a Dutch scholar has called it. The pro-sati group defends the possibility of self-immolation as a voluntary act, whereas the opponents argue that it is not possible to speak about a free will of women in traditional Hindu society because they have been taught not to make any decision in their life by themselves. It is no real choice when a widowed woman whose remarriage is out of the question in traditional Hindu society can only choose between physical death or social death. The occurrence of sati has led to the erection of new and the reconstruction of old sati shrines where religious worship is conducted on a daily basis. The RSSS alone administers 105 sati shrines in India. The new Indian Commission of Sati Prevention Act, which was promulgated in 1988 following the Rup Kumar case, enabled the government to close or remove sati temples and shrines. But obstruction and non-enactment of Indian central government directives at regional level, regional state level, have often prevented this and led to ongoing legal wrangles. Lawrence van der Busch, who's written this article on the burning question, sati and sati temples as the focus of political interest, he has argued that the phenomenon of sati and sati shrines in recent Indian history, I quote, has produced a discussion on fundamental problems in the political arena of India, of which the end is not yet in sight. The first question is that of the relation between the freedom of religion, as guaranteed in the Constitution, and the Commission of Sati Prevention Act. Within this context, the definition of religion is a burning issue. Should the practice of sati be regarded as a highly meritorious religious act in which divine reality expresses itself in female form, or is it only a social evil and a crime characteristic of a culture which is dominated by blameworthy macho values presenting themselves disguised in a religious luster of holiness? The Indian women's movement fights against sati and the reconstruction of sati temples, which some regard as a revival of traditional religion, so often oppressive to women. According to Van den Busch, for Indian feminists, there is no place in a civilized country as India for institutions which promote an inhuman, misogynist ideology under the disguise of religion. But with this standpoint, the Indian women's rights activists make religion subordinate to more general human principles and restrict the freedom of religion. That's the argument. This tension between two different kinds of rights, that of religion and that of women, is nowhere more visible than in Indian right-wing politics, where the right to religious freedom is used to defend and support abuses against women in the name of traditional religious customs. And this brings me to my last section. The right to religious freedom and women's human rights in India, is there an insoluble conflict? Gabriel Dietrich, who has Indian nationality and lives in India, has analyzed the tension between the constitutionally secular state of India, the freedom of religion and women's rights in her book Reflections on the Women's Movement in India, Religion, Ecology and Development. She argues that many human rights violations are inflicted on Indian women by the different religion-based personal laws. Furthermore, women's rights are constantly violated in the name of the freedom of religion. An increase in violence in family and public life is linked to the widespread assumption, according to her, that women are the property of their family and their husbands. The demands for women's human rights are becoming ever more contradictory through the widespread appeal to tradition, linked to the rise of Hindu religious revivalism, communalism, and fundamentalism over recent years. These are closely tied up with Hindu nationalism and its reaffirmation of tradition against the perceived threat of secular and Western influences. The strains of modernity have led to a defense of tradition, but the content and contours of Hindu religious and cultural tradition are quite differently interpreted by different revivalist Hindu organizations, with the Vishwa Hindu Parishad as the most prominent, speaking neither for nor against Sati, and the Hindu Mahasabha, supporting the pro-Sati Rajputs, also enjoying a large following. Political right-wing groups such as the BJP and the RSS with their Hindutva ideology have appropriated women's rights and gender issues for their own purposes. Woman, in quotation mark, and tradition, in quotation mark, have become again highly contested fields of discourse, like in the 19th century, but in a completely different political climate and with different issues at stake. Emphasis has shifted from the earlier concerns of the 20th century when traditional ideals of Indian womanhood were claimed on behalf of the modernizing project of nationalism to those of the 21st century where the debate is now focused on the complex issues of the relationship between tradition and universal human rights, with women human rights an even more contested area. Indian nationalism and communalism are predominantly represented by the Hindu right, although there are also some Muslim and Sikh right groups. The Hindu right, according to Arati Rao, is active through more than 500 organizations in India today. This is irrespective on who has the political power. There are 500 or about 500 Hindu right, radical right organizations, many with paramilitary training for male and female cadets. Right-wing nationalists recognize a public role for women, although their ideal woman remains linked to the traditional roles of wife and mother, even when dedicated to the nationalist cause. Unfortunately, members of the Hindu right have aligned themselves with women's rights issues by hijacking the demands for uniform civil code within a framework for equality and justice, but stated in terms of women's, in quotation mark, natural roles and obligations in the family. Now, in terms of kind of meta-discourse, it's very interesting how this argument is presented, because some people will say they are hijacking the gender discourse, the women's rights discourse, for their own purposes. Others will say they're appropriating this discourse. Others will say they're aligning themselves to what is fashionable at the moment. So you get, you know, quite a different tone and quite a different perspective who is commenting on the situation. Arati Rao writes, Hindu right organizations bring together women from the same background, class and castes. Similarities of experience forge a sense of unity of identity alongside a unity of purpose, which encourages a heightened communal solidarity. Feminist groups, by contrast to the Hindu right groups, bring together women from diverse backgrounds to work on issue-based projects that benefit themselves as well as others. Although Hindu nationalism is mainly a political phenomenon, it has appropriated certain aspects of traditional Hinduism, which affect women in very important ways. The Hindu right's dream of a Hindu India, rooted in the perceived superiority of the Hindu majority, can have frightening consequences for the status of Indian women. Even more frightening is the extraordinary violence adopted by some of the women activists in Hindu communal politics, especially as promoted by the women's organizations affiliated to the RSS, VHP, and BJP. The role of women in the militant Hindu right has so far been little studied, especially their involvement in militant actions against Muslims and Sikhs. You see, Hindu fundamentalists, again, you get a number of studies dealing with Hindu fundamentalists, but very, very few works look specifically at women and what the position of women in Hindu fundamentalists. For example, two of the most passionate speakers for the destruction of the Ayodhya Mosque in 1992 were two militant right-wing women leaders, Uma Bharati and Sadhvi Ritambara. And another 5,000 women right-wing activists took part in this violent wave. Event, 5,000 women, can you imagine, at the Ayodhya Mosque. The emergence of militant female leadership has been encouraged by the Hindu right, for whom women can assume an activist role without violating the traditional norms of Hindu womanhood. Here a link can be seen to the great goddesses such as Durga and Kali, but also to the patriotic song Banda Mataram, praising the mother goddess of the nation. And the Hindu right speaks about the Matri Shakti, the power of the mother, but it's used in this subversive way, if you like. The politicization of Hinduism for the realization of traditional agendas can only mean that women's rights will remain aligned to traditional values, which often entail women's unfreedom. For some women activists, the liberation of women means only the liberation from atrocities, but not that women should be free from their traditional duties as wives and mothers. Whether the appropriation of women's rights language in the name of political fundamentalism will ultimately enforce women's oppression and bondage or open the way to greater freedom has yet to be seen. It remains unpredictable at present whether Hinduism will allow for constructive reinterpretation within a secular framework and thereby facilitate the development of a truly universalist, inclusive spirituality which alone can affirm and empower women in a true sense. At times, the tension and conflict between women's rights and traditional Hinduism seems insoluble. Women's situation is often distressing and disheartening, but at other times it's also evident that there are many signs of hope in a country as vast and diverse as India. Like in many other countries of the world, there is still a long way to go before human rights literacy, which is now very much promoted, human rights literacy, which is such a recent development in global human history, can be more fully developed through an advance in education and the conscientization of policymakers and people on a large scale who can contribute to the crucial increase in awareness which is so necessary for the full empowerment of women. Much of this depends on education. This has been very well expressed by a former judge of the Indian Supreme Court who gave a convocation address on gender justice given at an Indian women's university. This was Justice V. R. Krishna I, a man who said, I quote, "The Constitution is a great instrument which frowns upon discrimination against women and sanctions affirmative action in favor of women. Nevertheless, the whole gamut of Indian jurisprudence in action has an unwritten estrangement against women. The tragedy is that despite all expectations and promises, home is the girl's prison and the woman's workhouse. This hostile climate results in frustration and denial of the enormous human potential latent in womanhood for society's advance. The only way equal gender can be claimed as of right is through education." This is still the judge speaking. "The potential for prosperity of a country or of the world depends not on the abundance of its revenues, nor on the strength of its arsenals, but it depends on cultivated citizens, particularly its women, energized by education, enlightenment, character, determination, and dynamism. No nation has a future with all the foreign investments, glamorous consumer goods, easy loans from abroad, and the corruption that goes with these sources is if women are unfree. On the contrary, Operation Education is the surest process to make India great. Operation Education. However," and this is my last page, "however, education alone will not be able to resolve the current conflict between the right to religious freedom and the rights of women. greater political openness and maturity, further legal changes, changes in traditional social practice and the distribution of economic power, the more flexible, dynamic and pluralistic understanding of Hinduism, and the further growth of a truly collaborative, inclusive women's activist movement within a secular All India framework seem equally essential for achieving full human worth and dignity for all women in India. Radhika Kumaraswamy, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, I think this position has just changed now, has eloquently argued that human rights have become universal in scope and application in today's global and pluralistic world, but that the articulation of women's human rights also produces new thinking and approaches to human rights at the international level, while not resolving their collision with cultural movements at the national level. She comments, I quote, "Human rights discourse is a powerful tool with which to criticize states, the political level, at the international global level. Nonetheless, insofar as this discourse concerns a woman's private life, it is actually in many societies quite a weak discourse, particularly in the context of family and community relations. The reality in many societies is that women's rights are under challenge from alternative cultural expressions. This phenomenon is deeply troubling. Regardless of all the international standards and accompanying national legislation, unless there is resonance in national civil society, there is little scope for real transformation at the national level when it comes to family and community in many countries. Civil society is far more conservative. This national struggle is the difficult fight, not the international one. Unless human rights discourse finds legitimacy in these areas of a country's national life, women's rights and human rights will remain mere words on paper. In Kumaraswamy's view, the next decade will have to show whether the tension between national and international understanding of women human rights can be resolved. During that time, it will also become clearer whether Indian political developments and the freedom of Hindus to practice their religion will include the necessary conditions not to abuse, but provide full support for Indian women and their human rights. Thank you.